This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There was a lot of anticipation leading up to the Iowa caucuses last night, as people following the horse race expected to get their first look at what at least one small segment of the American populace is thinking about the Democratic candidates for president. But the results were not forthcoming. According to the Iowa Democratic Party, glitches in the reporting process have led to delays. And at the end of the night, candidates, reporters, voters, and observers still didn't know the final tallies. At his watch party in Des Moines, Iowa, Vermont Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders addressed the situation.
Let me begin by stating that I imagine, have a strong feeling that at some point the results will be announced. And when those results are announced, I have a good feeling we're going to be doing very, very well here in Iowa.
So Bernie Sanders there spinning the unknown into a positive. But in fact, as we go live here in the noon hour, we still don't know the results from Iowa and whether Sanders did very, very well or just okay. VPR reporter and All Things Considered host Henry Epp has been in Iowa reporting on the Sanders campaign and the caucus process. And he joins us now. Henry, thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what you experienced last night, and then we can talk a little bit about what's happening today. One of the things you experienced was very little sleep, so I very much appreciate you being on the show. Yeah. But your reporting took you to one specific precinct, and I'm hoping that you can tell us about it, where you were, you set the scene, where were people gathering, who was there, how long did it all go on for?
Yeah, so I went to this precinct in Ankeny, Iowa, which is a suburb of Des Moines, just north of Des Moines. And it's sort of where I was in this event space, which is within this mixed use development area that, I mean, it all looked like it had been built in the last like 3 years or so. Lots of new housing. It's a really fast growing suburb. About 195 people showed up. That was actually lower than what the chair had predicted before people started showing up. He had thought there were going to be closer to 300. But once people were there, they came in, seemed ready to support their candidates right away. They all quickly went to the areas of the room that are designated for their choice. There's some party business that has to happen in a caucus, and then organizers have to count the room and then count everyone's choices. And then there's this realignment process for campaigns that don't reach 15%. And all told, it took about an hour and a half. In terms of the results at this one precinct, Sanders came out on top with three state delegates, and then Biden, Warren, and Buttigieg each got two delegates. But the process lasted a while, and it's a big commitment for someone on a weeknight to come out and go through this process that's, you know, at a lot of times not totally clear, what's going on in the room.
Well, speaking of which, you spoke with one person who was there, Tanya Cartier, who attended the caucus with her 14-year-old and her 1.5-year-old. And I understand you asked her how late she was willing to stay. Let's listen.
As late as I can. I'm hoping that I can be part of the whole process. But at some point, a 1.5-year-old has to go to bed. And I think it's around 8 o'clock now.
What's the sort of frustration or conflict for people who have other things in their lives?
Yeah, well, her kind of great quote to me was that, she said, "I'm so lucky I'm not a single parent. If I was, this would be way harder." She had her 14-year-old sort of taking care of her 1.5-year-old in the room, and the 1.5-year-old was, was a runner and was kind of, trying to make a break for it at certain points.
I'm familiar with how that works.
Yeah. And so, so she just said, it's, I asked her how long she was willing to stay. It was 8 o'clock. She'd been there for an hour. She's said, "I hope to stay as long as I can. But it's 8 o'clock and my toddler's got to go to bed soon." That's where things just get a little bit messy, I think, for some people in terms of access to this process. And there's a lot that has to go on, the initial count, their realignment. Another thing that got a little messy in the process was these presidential preference cards that everyone got. And the organizers at this particular precinct didn't make it very clear, from my view, in terms of what voters were supposed to fill out, when they were supposed to fill them out. Some people were filling out their cards too soon and had to redo them. Ultimately, at the end of the night, things did wrap up at about 8:30 at this precinct. They got a count that all the campaigns agreed on, and things stayed relatively civil, but there was just clearly a little bit of frustration with the process in the room.
Well, I hope that 1.5-year-old got to bed and got a good night's sleep.
Yeah, me
but
too.
Not a lot of other people did, as we mentioned, because, you know, even though it sort of all got clarified and the presidential preference cards got sorted out, that doesn't mean that when it came to all of the precincts reporting, all of the caucus sites reporting their tally, and what had happened, we now know that did not go smoothly either. And we still don't know, as I'm talking to you now, what the final results are. And, you know, so just recap for people who, I don't know, maybe slept through all of the news this morning. What happened?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, essentially, from what I've been hearing is that the Iowa Democratic Party was finding some inconsistencies in the results that were coming in through this app that they were using to get all the results from all the different precincts. And they want to really double check and make sure that the results that they put out are accurate. And so they, my understanding is they gave precinct chairs, you know, the option of putting in the results through the app or calling in on the phone. The phone lines got really backed up. So it just, you know, dragged on into the night and there were no results coming out. I was at the Bernie Sanders watch party. And as we heard earlier, you know, he came out after several other candidates had come out at their own watch parties and sort of spun a positive message. He did the same thing, said he's optimistic. But, you know, for everyone, there was nothing to go on.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a little bit unusual, and certainly for the candidates who were hoping to use, you know, whatever came out of Iowa to sort of move into New Hampshire and either say, no, now we have to make the push, or wasn't that great, let's keep going. It certainly complicates things, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But also, I understand the Sanders campaign actually released its own results in the meantime. Yeah. While we're waiting for the official ones.
Yeah, so late at night, sometime after midnight, I believe, Central Time here, the Sanders campaign put out results, which they said were from 40% of precincts based on their internal reporting. And I mean, so that's what's interesting, right, is like, you know, you can be at a precinct and see what happens at individual precincts. So that's likely, you know, where they're getting this information. And I would take these results with a huge grain of salt because they're from a specific campaign, not from the Democratic Party. But Sanders' results showed just a couple percentage points ahead of Pete Buttigieg. I think Sanders was at 28%. Buttigieg was at about 25. Again, these are not official results and could very well be skewed a bit more favorably to Sanders since they're coming from his own campaign.
Well, interesting that they're also releasing for the other candidates as well, you know, their own.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they had a full spread. And it really, I mean, what it seemed like based on those results were that there's sort of a top four in this race. Sanders,
which was expected.
Exactly. But in terms of the Sanders results, they did put Sanders above anyone else. But those other candidates, not too far behind. And again, what do these numbers even mean?
And as for Sanders himself, he's already left the state. I mean, he's got stuff to do in New Hampshire, I hear.
Yeah. So he's holding a rally tonight in Milford, New Hampshire. And then, according to his schedule, he's supposed to give a State of the Union response in Manchester late tonight. And then he's holding a town hall on Wednesday morning in Derry. And after that, he has to go back to Washington to vote on whether to convict President Donald Trump in the impeachment trial.
Busy weekend. We should point out he's not officially giving the Democratic response to the State of the Union address. He always, I think, gives a response and posts it on his website and on Facebook after the State of the Union address.
That's right.
That's VPR's Henry Epp reporting from Iowa, where, again, the results are still unknown as we're live here at 12:17. Henry, you're also on your way back to the Northeast, correct?
I am. I'll be flying back later today.
All right. Well, safe travels and thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Joining us for our conversation about New Hampshire is John Gregg, news editor of the Valley News. His weekly column for the paper is called Primary Source. John, it's nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane.
And Dante Scala, professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire and a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy, is also with us today. Dante, nice to talk with you as well.
Good afternoon.
right?
So, John Gregg, let me start with you. Most of the candidates, including Sanders, were planning to use this momentum that they had coming out of Iowa, whether it was momentum from being a front runner or momentum of saying, look, we got to make the push now, to really rally New Hampshire voters. So what do they do now that they're in New Hampshire? They're coming to New Hampshire, but nobody knows what happened in Iowa.
Right. It's a bit like operating in a vacuum. Campaigns are going to rely on the familiar, right? They have to go about their business. Candidates have to get in front of voters and so forth and so on. But, you know, clearly something's missing from the equation, right? Iowa and New Hampshire have been partners for so long in the nomination process in terms of bestowing momentum on the one hand, but also eliminating candidates on the other. Like last night, we fully expected, you know, some winning stories, but also some candidates to exit the stage. And none of that has happened. And now I'm not sure it's going to happen before New Hampshire votes.
Wait, you think we might not even know before New Hampshire votes, Dante?
Well, I mean, I don't have any special insight into the workings of the Iowa Democratic Party, but nothing that's happened in the last 24 hours gives me much confidence, number one. And number two, I think the further away we get from Iowa and the actual caucus night, the less impact Iowa is likely to have on New Hampshire's results. Now, you know, couple that with the fact that campaigns themselves, which are just furious about last night's debacle, and rightly so, were raising doubts about the integrity of the process. So not only does Iowa need to issue prompt results in order to have an impact on the next week, but also they need to be above reproach. And that, from my vantage point right now, seems to be a tall order.
Yeah, John Gregg, what do you think about that? I mean, it sort of, we're already seeing some of the candidates, in fact, talk in a way that some people don't like about, well, look what happened in Iowa. It's not verified results. This wasn't a good process. Has something gone wrong? Has there been voter fraud? Which there's, to be clear, is no sign of. There's no sign that anything was hacked. There's no sign, at least according to the Democratic Party in Iowa, that the problem was, you know, somebody maliciously doing something wrong with the app that people were supposed to use. But nonetheless, does this then change the confidence that perhaps voters have in New Hampshire as they move toward, you know, the New Hampshire primary?
Well, I think there is, you know, a concern that this might certainly suppress some of the enthusiasm that some of the candidates, especially Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, might have been hoping to you know, rally out of Iowa. But I think also they have very established campaign networks, offices, and the, you know, the so-called ground game in New Hampshire, and they're just going to, you know, work that relentlessly. I mean, I think what's interesting with Sanders, you know, is that, and we had him in for an editorial board meeting, and this is something he said all the time, he really thinks he can broaden the base and bring in new voters to the political process. We've seen him do that somewhat, or at least have a wide base in Vermont with, you know, the Northeast Kingdom conservative voters who are Bernie fans. So, you know, he's going to try and do that in New Hampshire with Pete Buttigieg, who, you know, from certainly the unofficial numbers, people think is going to do very well. There has been a lot of enthusiasm for him that we've seen in the Upper Valley. He had about 1,300 people at a rally in Lebanon a little more than a month ago, which was a very large crowd for the Upper Valley. So, you know, they're going to push that out. And I saw a listing early this morning. There were already 85 different candidate events scheduled all over the state for the various candidates.
Did you say 8,500 or 85?
No, 85.
I think I put on the double zeros there, and I was like, that's not what he said. Is it 8,500? Wouldn't surprise me, though, at this point in some ways when you get all the surrogates in there. Listeners, this may be a good entry point for you if you have thoughts. First of all, You know, Pete Buttigieg was one of the candidates who really needs a good showing in Iowa to help sort of boost the momentum and the enthusiasm going into New Hampshire. So barring the results from Iowa, you know, what are you thinking as the Buttigieg campaign moves to New Hampshire? And then also for listeners, I'm wondering what you think about this question of integrity of the voting process. And, you know, this is something that we've been hearing from various people. We've heard it from the president. And now we are, as I mentioned, hearing some comments from the Democratic candidates and their surrogates about this process. And so, you know, how do you sort of want the candidates to move forward talking about the integrity of the voting process in the primary and whether or not that's a concern to you? Again, our number, if you want to weigh in or ask a question, is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also dash off an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. And Professor Scala, what about the Buttigieg campaign? I mean, how does that campaign position itself today and in the next couple of days here in New Hampshire?
Well, it can, you know, I think what Buttigieg hopes is that last night was just one big hiccup and that results will be published promptly and that he will emerge at the top or near the top of the Iowa caucuses and then try to use that to, you know, gain momentum better late than never. I agree, he's had a top-tier campaign operation all along, right up there with Sanders, right up there with Elizabeth Warren. And what I'm curious about is how well he can build on his appeal to more affluent, college-educated, white-collar Democrats. And there are an awful lot of them here in New Hampshire, both in the Upper Valley, but really throughout the state. That's the challenge right now. The dilemma for him is that, you know, Sanders has led in the last 9 or 10 New Hampshire polls over the last couple weeks, and it's been a consistent lead. And the other problem is that given that there are no results, no one's going up or down necessarily. I mean, it looked as if Joe Biden, who is one of Buttigieg's competitors for the so-called moderate lane, right, that block of moderate voters, looked like he was on his way to a bad evening last night. But again, now we don't know. Elizabeth Warren is still in the race, right? And so there's a lot of competition to get to Sanders or get up to his level. And I think, you know, at least when the week started, Sanders was not in a commanding position in New Hampshire, but I think it's fair to say he had the inside track on a victory here.
Let's go to Luther, who's calling in from Montreal. Luther, hi, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
So I'm wondering, how could Sanders supporters not be cynical of what's going on or conspiratorial to some degree, given the shenanigans of the DNC and the establishment the last time around in 2016.
So when you say the shenanigans, explain what you're talking about, the fact that the DNC, you know, exactly what are you thinking that
sure.
The Sanders people are going to be skeptical of now?
Okay, so I'll give you some examples. So for one, they cheated in a number of ways. Donna Brazile gave Hillary Clinton questions. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Clinton acolyte, made the debates on nights when people weren't most likely not going to pay attention. Hillary Clinton ran the fundraising for the whole DNC, effectively creating a money laundering campaign to flush all the money towards her. Amongst other things, they knocked voters off the rolls in New York. They made false claims about, you know, throwing chairs in Nevada.
Yeah, so Luther,
I don't have all of them.
Luther, let me give this question to our guests, but I'm curious as well. You're calling in from Montreal. Are you a voter in the U.S. or are you just interested in this stuff?
Interested. Not a voter, but however, it does affect me because Canada dovetails its policies with America. And so long as the American foreign policy works on a petrol dollar, and so long as there's a war economy and an oil economy and a neoliberal economy, we're going to have the same kind of effects in Canada that you're affected by in America.
Yeah, Luther, so interesting to hear from you and how invested and engaged you are in the U.S. elections. And as you point out, the U.S. elections have ripple effects throughout the world, and certainly with our largest trading partner, Canada. So, John Gregg, what about what Luther is talking about here? You know, and there are both a lot of issues with the 2016 campaign and some conspiracy theories and some bruised feelings still. And those things are sometimes hard to tease apart. But to Luther's point, you know, this is what I was sort of getting at, that people, if they're starting to question the integrity of the primary process, that could have problems for the candidates. It certainly also could be a problem for the U.S. election system in general and our ideas about how the democratic process works. You know, and here's Luther bringing up the 2016 campaign and how Bernie supporters might be feeling about it.
Sure. Well, there's no question that there's a good argument that the DNC had its thumb on the scale 4 years ago. I think the irony here is, as I understand it, the plan to report three different tallies out of Iowa was actually part of a DNC sort of unity compromise. But, you know, it goes back just like in 1992. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, maybe they should have realized keep it simple, stupid. I mean, you know, three different votes coming out of caucuses are pretty difficult to do. You know, it's possible this certainly could keep swirling. On the other hand, what if we get results in the next 12 hours and it shows Sanders with, you know, a decent finish, several percentage points ahead of his candidates? This may be a little bit of a tempest in a teapot. But there's no question that losing the ability to have the victory speech and the momentum coming in here and the realignment, frankly, of I was curious about what might happen with some of the more centrist candidates like Amy Klobuchar and Biden even coming out of Iowa and whether they would coalesce if one of them did very badly in Iowa.
Well, you say not having the victory speech, but as we know, Pete Buttigieg gave the victory speech, not knowing what the results would be. And certainly, you know, we heard Bernie Sanders at the top of the show saying, I think we're going to do very, very well in Iowa. So they were sort of trying to spin a victory speech out of not knowing what was actually happening. And Dante Scala, you know, I think it's interesting, this question of the sort of Democratic or Democratic Party and how it supports or doesn't support Senator Sanders in his bid to become the presidential nominee, but then also what Sanders voters will do if he's not the nominee. And there was a recent poll from Emerson College that suggested that Bernie Sanders supporters are less likely than some of the supporters of other candidates to vote for the eventual Democratic nominee, should that nominee not be Sanders. And so some of the candidate supporters say, look, if it's not my person, I'm going to vote for whoever wins the nomination. That's not really the case for Sanders supporters. A little over 50% of them said, yeah, I'll vote for whoever. But that means that, you know, a very large minority said either I'm not going to vote for the eventual nominee if it's not Sanders, or it depends on who it is. So what does that mean then for the Democratic establishment as it thinks about who it wants its nominee to be?
Yeah, it means one giant headache. It's, you know, a couple things. You know, the Iowa caucuses are much more opaque and complicated than the primary that New Hampshire holds, which is just like a general election, which people are accustomed to participating in across the country and even the world. But caucuses are a different animal altogether. And so when you create a complicated process that can be somewhat opaque, and then you put it in the national spotlight at the front of the line with, you know, this international media glare upon it, you know, you're just asking for trouble. And this wasn't the first time that the caucuses had run into trouble. Remember, 8 years ago, the Iowa Republicans declared the wrong winner, right? They declared Mitt Romney had won the Iowa caucuses when, in fact, it had been Rick Santorum, which they didn't correct for days and days. So that's and, you know, Republicans are sitting back at this point, and they're just smiling because, you know, literally, they've been saying the Democrats are in disarray, and now, literally, they're in disarray. Now, maybe this will be, as John mentioned, you know, maybe this is a hiccup or a bump in the road, and it's business as usual, and we're all being a bit breathless about it because the national political media and the punditry have all been anticipating this for so long. Maybe it's the case that for ordinary voters, they just kind of shrug and they're more patient than we are. But this could have ramifications for the whole process if Iowa doesn't have its usual impact, because that throws everyone's calculations off. All the campaigns and so forth had this planned out a certain way, and now maybe it's going to be different.
Let's get a couple more calls in here before we move to another topic of discussion. Renee is calling in, I believe, from Loveland, Colorado. Renee, go right ahead.
Oh, hi. I guess what I was calling in about was the problem I have with these early election or caucus results is that it later on deters people from voting in the election period during November.
Why?
Well, I think that if they see that, well, if Iowa caucuses have already determined who the president-elect is going to be or whatever the case may be, why bother voting?
So you think that these early states wind up deterring people from voting in their own primaries, and so the early states maybe have more of an influence on who becomes the eventual nominee than you'd like to see? Is that sort of where you're going with this?
Yes, I think you put that better than I did.
Well, Renee, I really appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Let's get another one in from Jacqueline, who's calling in from Montgomery. And Jacqueline, I think you're calling in from Vermont, not Alabama, but we're unsure today because people are calling in from all over the place. So go ahead. What are you thinking?
Well, I want to say good morning and that you do a great job. I'm thinking that all of our distress and obsession with the results from Iowa speak in part to our addiction to instant results. And rather than lunging to blame and conspiracy, there's a paper trail. They use pencils and paper and pen and paper. And the people in Iowa need time to go unfold those pieces of paper and count them just like we do here in Vermont. And as far as Iowa creating the momentum, it's also media created. People really aren't paying that much attention right now, and most of Iowa is white, so I say let's just move along.
Yeah, Jacqueline, thanks. Yeah, thanks for your thoughts. And John Gregg, what do you think? I mean, there is this sort of like, oh my gosh, Iowa, and all of these people now, especially in the media, wondering what happened? Where is this going? What are the results going to tell us as we move toward New Hampshire? But Jacqueline is saying, just, you know, calm down. And in some ways, it doesn't matter. New Hampshire voters get to vote on their own time and in their own primary, and so do the rest of us. So, you know, let's sort of chill out a little bit and not put so much weight on these early states, particularly ones that are maybe not demographically representative of the United States. What do you think, John?
Yeah, no question about it. I guess this is a little heretical to say coming from a New Hampshire paper, but there's you know, there's no question the New Hampshire primary might have more undue influence or less influence than it thinks it does. I was looking at the calendar ahead, and besides Super Tuesday, I think a really interesting state, especially for Bernie Sanders in the issue of electability, is Ohio, which I think comes up in later in March. And that's always a central, very, very important state in the general election, but also obviously a very diverse state with a lot going on. So, for instance, if he's got the standard bearer on one side and then there's a more centrist candidate, that could be a pretty interesting primary.
Yeah, it all remains to be seen what happens. And certainly, you know, the horse race, people complain about horse race politics, but it's also interesting to see at a moment in time where candidates stand and what voters of any demographic are thinking. And so we'll be eager to see what happens in Iowa, what the results are, and certainly what happens in New Hampshire. And I appreciate both of you being with us today to join us in this sort of preview of New Hampshire and post-view, sort of mid-view of Iowa. John Gregg is news editor of the Valley News, and his weekly column is called Primary Source. Dante Scala is a professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire and a fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. Dante, John, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jane.